Welcome to After Hours at the Radio Book Club, which is a podcast produced by KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. Arsene Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore is my co-host, and we are an award-winning podcast. We can announce that because in June, Public Radio News Directors Inc., that's Prindy, which is a nationwide body of public media, recognised at the After Hours at the Radio Book Club in their excellence awards for excellence in podcasting. So congratulations, Arsene.
Thank you. You do most of the hard work. I just get to sit here.
I press the buttons.
You press the button. Oh, I think that's hard. I wouldn't know which buttons to press.
But you pick the book, so that's hard. And the book that you have selected for this month is The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay. And do check out the book club edition of this interview, because Rebecca talked a lot about AIDS in the Chicago in the 1980s, which is one of the time periods in the book. 2015 in Paris is another time period. And there was a major event that happened in Paris that I was wondering when I was reading. Mm. Okay, she's in Paris, 2015. Will you cover what happened, which was the Bataclan, the shootings and the bombings that happened in Paris? I think it was November 2015. Well, sure enough, you did. Was that why you said it in 2015,
no.
Paris? Okay.
No, here's what happened. I was writing it in 2015. I'd been working on it for a couple of years at that point. I was really working on the Fiona sections, on the 2015 sections. And I was writing the fall of 2015 in the fall of 2015. I was staying at an artist residency near Chicago, and so really had, you know, all day, every day to work for a couple weeks there, and was really focused on her sections. And I was, you know, deep into my Paris research, and I kept going into, you know, you can go into Google Maps and you can drop the little guy in there and walk around and do the Google Street View. And, you know, it's just, you know, you can look down off a bridge. You can read the restaurant menus, you can go into certain stores. It's very much like being in Paris if you have an overactive imagination. And then the attacks happened. And so I was, you know, shaken on the level that I think so many of us were who, you know Paris and have been there. And I felt as if I had been there that morning. I also had to stop writing for a couple of months on her sections because I had no idea what to do. It mattered to me that it be kind of just about exactly 30 years since her brother had died, that I liked that symmetry. And I thought about moving it. So first I'm thinking, what if I move it earlier in 2015? But then I thought, no, then it's going to feel at the end like I'm leaving her there and this is about to happen and I'm suggesting something about that. So then I'm still thinking, well, maybe I can put it in 2016. Maybe I'll do it next year. So as it turns out, the spring of 2016, there's massive flooding in Paris, which I'd have to be writing about. And then I'm thinking, I'm dealing with incredibly politicized characters. There's no way they're going to be talking about anything other than politics if you put this in 2016, and then I have to deal with that, which I really didn't feel like writing about. So I was really worried about keeping it in. I didn't know how that would read. You know, it happens in the background. She's not there. Since we're giving spoilers here, you know, nobody is really, no characters are directly affected. It throws things into chaos a bit. It makes some things happen in Fiona's life, but nobody's injured. And it felt to me like one of the reasons, you know, I thought I would try it out and see if it worked. And one of the reasons I kept it was it felt thematic to me. It felt in keeping with these themes of people trying their best to live their lives, making enough trouble on their own with their dramas and messing up and being human, and then the just random brutality of the world and of men who don't care about you, who have power over your life because they are politicians or because they are terrorists, come sweeping through.
Yeah, one of the characters is a Fiona, kind of expresses that
yes.
in so many words. You know, says, you know, like our lives have enough going on without wars and all this other external drama.
Yeah, exactly.
And I thought thematically it worked because we talked in the previous interview about how really 1980s dealing with the AIDS crisis was like a battleground for so many people. They were like a war zone. They were holding hands. People were dying all day, every day. There were people, there was death. And so I thought that that was kind of symmetrical. But also, I think one of the characters said something after the 2015 attacks. It's like, things will really fundamentally change here and this will be an opportunity. I can't remember exactly what they said, but it was this sense that, you know, this will be an opportunity to clamp down on everything, you know, on the Muslims and everything. And I thought that's probably what happened in the 1980s. The homophobes were given even more of a platform.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it was a little bit of my nod toward what was happening politically at that point when I did resume writing, that, you know, this was something that would have repercussions. And, you know, at a certain point, Richard, the photographer character who's there in Paris with Fiona, says something about, do you ever feel like the progress we've made is temporary? You know, that we're, you know, we're going to be set back in certain ways. And I think that's something that, you know, is certainly in many ways happening in America right now. I wanted to acknowledge that in the book without taking us into the present day. And this, you know, was an opportunity for me to start to go there. These are people who've been around the bend a few times and they are going to be able to see it coming. So, you know, I think it's Richard's boyfriend who's actually extrapolating and saying, you know, they're going to crack down on, you know, it gives the anti-immigration people a platform, but those are the right-wing people. And then they crack down on people like me as well.
Yeah. What I was constantly thinking or rethinking about today's debates with the AIDS crisis more in mind. You know, we've gone through this last 5 to 10 years of time period. We're talking about gay marriage a lot. And, you know, I hadn't really thought about it so much in the terms of a lot of the people who are fighting for gay marriage, who are in their 40s, 50s, 60s, were the people who were in their 20s and 30s during the AIDS crisis.
Oh,
and
yeah.
What a subtext that is. And how that must run through this war that community had to go through in the 80s and early 90s, certainly, and how that subtext must still play out in today's debates. But it seems like the broader culture, it's never talked about in that terms. You know, it's just like it's always a very narrow focus, like about whether it's gay marriage or whether the guy who's baking the cake has to bake the cake or not. And there's no real understanding of this community just went through this not that long ago. And these people are the same people on the battle lines.
Yeah. And so much of what we know actually about effective protest and about direct action comes from these people and from ACT UP in specific, which, you know, I'm assuming a lot of people know, but if they don't, you know, was kind of the, you know, there were many different organizations that sprang up that were protesting, you know, governmental policies, exorbitant healthcare costs, things like that. But ACT UP was the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. Came about at sort of the end of the 80s, first in New York and then elsewhere. And so, you know, for me, talking to those people in Chicago, some of those ACT UP people who, you know, have other jobs too. You know, one of them that I talked to is a hairdresser. One was a bookseller, actually. But these are the people that then I can go, I have, at a certain point in the book, I'm talking about the 1990, there was a major ACT UP demonstration in Chicago in April of 1990 against the American Medical Association, which is headquartered in Chicago, and some insurance companies as well. And you can watch video of this on YouTube. Someone has uploaded all this camcorder footage of this incredible protest, and you can see these people, you know, lying in the streets, getting, you know, assaulted by the police, getting trampled or nearly trampled by horses. There's a certain point where five of them, and I write this in the book, they've broken into the county building, which the protest ended in front of, and it didn't break in, I should say. They snuck in straight drag. They put on Oxford shirts and ties, and then they got out on this ledge above this window, and they take off their Oxfords and they have ACT UP t-shirts underneath, and they unleash this huge banner that says "We demand equal health care now," and then they're one by one quite brutally dragged back in through the window. And I interviewed one of the guys who was out there on the ledge who's still alive. I believe two of the five have survived. I could be wrong about that, but these are people who, you know, the more I read about this, it's like these, I feel like I'm, you know, reading about an actual war. Like, this is, you know, I'm studying this at the same time that my kids are obsessed with Hamilton and they're reading about Revolutionary War heroes. And in my mind, you know, emotionally, they're getting kind of mixed up. And so I have the chance to sit across from this guy and I feel like I'm talking to, you know, like, George Washington, which seems ridiculous, you know. But at the same time, here's the thing: like, where are the monuments? Where are the movies? Where are the books? Where are the museums? Where, you know, you walk by the county building in Chicago, and you would have no reason to know that this major battle occurred there, and these people are still with us, and they still know how to fight, and they are still fighting, and it's incredible.
And in terms of, say, the relationship with younger generation now, who maybe are fighting different battles for the LGBTQ community, particularly transgender rights, or we've had marriage equality or other things like that, I mean, what is the sense of the relationship between the two? I mean, is there an acknowledgement that these people paved the way? I know there's always that tension between older protesters, pick your protest, and, sure, and the younger generation. But did you get a sense?
You know, I think that there is absolutely an understanding and a gratitude. But one thing I've heard expressed both from people of the older generation and people of the younger generation is that the younger generation has not been educated in what happened. You know, some of them might educate themselves. But, you know, this is my high horse of the week here, but here's the thing. You know, you take U.S. history in high school, and, you know, something like World War II, you probably spend 2 weeks on World War II. How long are people spending on the AIDS crisis in U.S. history right now?
Is it even in a book?
I mean, it's probably in the book if they get that far in the book before the end of the year.
The year ends in 1973.
I know, right? That always happened.
Nixon's
right?
Still president.
Yeah, right. That always happened. Every history class I ever took, I was like, whoops. So there's that. But also, you know, I've heard people talk about, you know, it was covered for, you know, maybe half a day. It was a mention of, you know, here was a thing that happened and now it's better, but there was some fighting and, the, you know, Reagan wasn't great about it. This is as people are free to disagree with me. I feel like this is as seminal of an event or an era in American history as World War II was, in that, you know, why do we study World War II? We study it so that this will never happen again. We study it to understand America as it is now and as it was. And we study the cause and effect involved in that. We should be studying the AIDS epidemic for the exact same reason. 35 million people have died of AIDS. And, I mean, that's versus like 600,000 in the Civil War. And you go over to your weird uncle's house and he has like 18 books about the Civil War, right? Like, where's your one, just one book about AIDS? Come on.
But as you said, those books don't exist. I mean, well, when you were, especially about Chicago.
Well, right. I mean, there are plenty out there. You know, Cleve Jones's new book is fantastic. I mentioned the David France book. You know, there are plenty of personal memoirs. There are plenty of novels and plays written by people who, you know, are, for instance, The Angel of History by Rabia Alameddine. He's, you know, someone who's living with HIV, writes about that. This is a novel about AIDS in many ways. Things, you know, plays like Angels in America, which is back on Broadway now, plays like The Normal Heart. So there's plenty out there that people could be reading. There's not nearly enough, right? So it doesn't let the people off the hook for not reading it. You can find some stuff. But at the same time, oh my God, where's all the other stuff, right?
Well, that's one of the things I loved about this novel. I mean, besides for being just a great novel, I mean, I really got into the characters. I was living with them in my heart for this past week, 10 days. But I feel like you're bringing a moment in history that needs more attention and giving it the attention and making, hopefully people will read this novel because maybe they read it just because they love novels, or if some people, maybe hopefully you have some people more like people like me who will read anything you write. So they're going to read this and that'll lead them on to something else.
Trick you into reading.
Yeah, but I think that, well, that was really the feeling I was left with. Like, I've got to read more. There should be more. This was a huge thing, and we barely talk about it now.
I'm happy to hear that, because I do feel, and you know, I was talking earlier about, you know, that question of appropriation a little bit, and my concern of, like, am I stealing space in some way? Ultimately, what I landed on is, no, that I have an opportunity to amplify more direct accounts, first-person accounts, nonfiction accounts, by promoting this book. And my great hope is that if this is the first thing someone's really read about AIDS, or if it's the first thing in a while that they've read about AIDS, that it will not be the last, and that, you know, you go, okay, this is what happened in Chicago, now what happened in Denver?
And it puts such a human face on it. I mean, because it's so easy to get lost in statistics and numbers and for all that to wash over you when you deal with an issue like this, you know, war or the AIDS crisis, when so many people die and continue to die. It really can kind of numb you to that, just dealing with the sheer volume of it also.
Right.
To get to know very intimately these characters as characters completely separate from the fact that they are gay and have AIDS. They
right.
have completely flushed out lives aside from that.
It was really important to me that they have a lot of other things going on, and that it wasn't this laser focus. You know, Yale's career is a really big part of this book and this this show that he's trying to put together in the art world. You know, Fiona's search for her daughter. It was, you know, I think that that can happen, that we try to write about a certain issue and we write only about that issue to the point where it becomes sort of grating and maybe not entirely believable.
Well, there were so many subplots. I love the Nora story, which was the original kernel of the idea, the 1920s art model in Paris. Is there a book out there? Or is she done? Nora's had her story.
Oh, who knows? I don't know. Yeah. I think she's probably done, but I've never say never.
Well, so Nora's in love with this guy, Ranko Novak. He's an artist. He runs in the crowd with Modigliani and some of the other people, but he never rises to those ranks. And he's kind of a bit of a mystery. You know, he dies young, and Nora has pined away for him for 60 years or whatever. And in your previous book, you kind of had a poet who was kind of people knew him in academic circles. Well, one guy knew him in academic circles who was trying to write a PhD on him. And he was kind of this hidden lost figure that there was some romance around.
Yeah.
So it seems like these kind of minor artists, there's something going on there
I
read this. And I was wondering, what draws you to people like Ranko Novak and Edwin Parfit, who add this texture to your book and mystery to your book, but really never quite made it?
Yeah,
anyway.
That's really funny. You're the first, I've never thought about the connection between those two characters before. You're the first person to ask me about that. So I love it. I think that, for one thing, my impulse in both of those characters, this is going to be such a bizarre answer, comes from Steve Martin. he's a very funny person. He's also written one of, I think, the best plays of the past 50 years, Picasso at the Le Pan Agile, which is funny. It's also a beautiful, quite serious play in many ways.
He's a great banjo player, too.
Okay, I know, right? Who knows what he can't do. So bear with me for a second. So within this play, he has basically, everything's at the Le Pan Agile, this famous, you know, bar, nightclub, whatever, in Paris. It's the 20s, and you got Picasso and all these, you know, everyone walking through the door is famous. And it's that sort of, you know, gosh, if I'd lived back then, I could have hung out with all these famous people. And you always imagine the very famous people who made it. And he has, though, this one character, I'm going to mangle his name, but it's something like Schmedley. It's just something ridiculous, who is also there and just keeps announcing his presence. And people are like, who are you? And he's like, I'm Schmedley. And he's no one, and no one's ever heard of him. And it's the joke. It's silly. But it's also like, no, that's real. You know, that's real life. I joke sometimes with one friend of mine in Chicago in the writer community that our constant joke is, when we're like in 100 years, who's the one writer that's still going to be getting read from Chicago? And we always pick someone like super weird and obscure who like it's going to be that guy. But because you just don't know, right? So I think that in both books, actually, a lot of my impulse, I can say this, I don't think, I know, in both Well, specifically for this one, I'm writing about her hanging out with all these famous artists. And it's like, at a certain point, I was like, gosh, every person who ever sketched her was famous, really? And so I went and I made up two of them. There's someone else who's made up in there, who kind of nobody really knows who this guy was. And then I'm going to make, you know, I'm going to really make one of these people a character. I think with Edwin Parfitt as well, I'm writing about, you know, in the 100-year house, this estate was an artist colony and also in the 20s. So I love the 20s. I'll just say that. That's part of what's going on here. But, you know, I was bringing in originally a lot of people who were famous and I changed that. But, you know, like who's the person who seemed so promising and nothing came of them? Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's an artist's neurosis too, of the kind of, you know, the work is its own reward and you just don't have control over how it's received and if anyone reads it, if anyone likes it, if anyone's going to remember it. And I think writing about those characters for whom work at least should have been the reward is maybe a way of working out some of that stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. You also mentioned you like to play with gaps in time. So the 100-year house, you tell that story backwards, you know, you start in the modern day and you go back 100 years and all these things that are kind of mysteries in the modern times, like, you know, even things about why the wall is like this or something, start becoming exposed as you go back in time.
Right.
And this one, of course, we've talked about, you have the 80s, you have 2015, but you also have the 20s. And what do gaps in time give you as a novelist?
I mean, I think there's that sort of frisson of, you know, recognition of... You can do a lot with dramatic irony that way, actually, where, you know, it puts the reader or the kind of the ear of the story, the theoretical receiver of the story in this privileged position where we know more than the characters do by virtue of our being able to see more than one era. And, you know, I think that happened... you know, in the 100-year house, it's happening all over the place. We are the only ones who have the whole story. In The Great Believers, certainly someone like Fiona does have the whole story. So when we are in 2015, we don't have that position of privilege anymore. But when we're, you know, as we learn more and more in 2015, then as we go back to 1985, 86, 87, we know things. And that changes our relationship to that story. And I find that really... That's one of the things that just gives me writer goosebumps, you know? I just like it.
Well, Rebecca Mackay has been with us. After Hours at the Radio Book Club, a podcast which is a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. It's an award-winning podcast now. It's official. So you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And Rebecca Mackay, thank you.
Thank you.